Tonight on The Good Atheist, Ryan joins me as we talk about drugs. Welcome to the show. My name is Jacob Fortin.
And I'm Ryan Harkness.
I'm trying to be a bit more singy, you know, have that spirit of, what's what I'm looking for? Good nature? Because actually today was a fucking great day. I don't know if you noticed, like, we actually received some donations, so I'm going to be able to give out more free memberships to people and stuff like that. It's just been a good day.
It was beautiful. Beautiful weather. Beautiful everything. I agree with you for the most part. Except, I did one thing. I ate a fucking thing of cookies. Like an entire thing.
Like, what do you mean by a thing? What is a thing? Like a pallet? A truck?
Like one of those semi-bag things. It's like 350 grams of cookies. They went in my mouth. All of them.
So you could tell me how many calories you just consumed.
Let me take a look. For two cookies is 110 calories, and that's 24 grams divided by 350 grams. I ate, actually that's not too bad, 1,700 calories worth of cookies. So I ate pretty much my day's worth of calories.
What do you mean that's not so bad? That's an extra almost 2,000 calories.
Well, what I do, if I eat an entire box of cookies, I'm not still having the other three meals during the day.
So you're just eating cookies then?
Well, I didn't say it was a good thing. I said it was the one bad thing. Leave me alone.
So you only do one bad thing a day and that's what you eat? Like somehow you this is how you create that equilibrium. Well, I did something really bad, so instead I'm not going to eat.
Look, this isn't a regular thing. Actually, I've been really good lately. It's just that today I went a little bit overboard. That's all right.
And it's just because it was a beautiful day, a day for cookies?
Well, no, it was a beautiful day except for the fact that I ended up eating all those cookies. And I just brought it up because, you know, I haven't been eating all those cookies. It's no longer a thing that I do. And now that I am, I'm just kind of like, now that I did it again, I just had to bring it up. I just had to mention the fact that I totally pigged out.
It's really, you know what, here's the thing. And I guess we're going to have the whole, today's podcast is going to center around one theme, and that's drugs, and part of that is going to probably deal with food, which to some of us is a kind of drug. And the basic lesson I think that you're going to pull from this whole show, if I can say the end before, you know, the beginning, is that you're going to learn that it's really hard for human beings to control habits that they find pleasurable, even if those habits are kind of bad for them. That's the lesson. But there's not going to be a lot of morality to the show, because here's one thing. When it comes to drugs and conversation about it, I'm of the opinion that we should always know a lot more about drugs than not know anything about them. You know what I mean? Like it serves no purpose to have this kind of attitude that we're like, oh, well, some drugs are bad, some drugs are good, and we're like, well, let's have an adult conversation about it. And the funny thing is, I bet you, of all the controversial conversations that we've ever had, this show would probably be, to a lot of people, the most controversial because of how they feel about drugs.
Yeah, it's quite a possibility.
And we've said some insanely controversial things over the year. Need I remind you of the abortion van? And that's just one among many.
Do you remember when we were talking about Anne Frank masturbating for like half an hour?
Yeah, we talked about her tiny little vagina.
My goodness.
And how that made you feel like the pervert that you are. We're just waiting for that day, by the way, where you just finally admit that you're one of those creepy, hangs around the park flying a kite, little stash with the big glasses type molester.
I do hang out at the park and I do fly kites and I do at the moment have a pretty creepy beard, but it does not make me a molester, and I refuse to, I can't say admit, because that does sound like I'm hiding something, but I refuse your hypotheses that I'm a pervert. I reject it.
Of course, all perverts reject that hypothesis. It's the perfect alibi. There's a few things that I want to talk about. Number one is the effects on drug prohibitionism on society in general. Okay, we're also going to talk about what is a drug. Like, how do we define drugs? How are they understood? We're also going to be talking about some of the opinions that people have either for or against the prohibition of drugs. And then finally, we're going to actually talk about some of the real consequences of making drugs illegal, and sort of what is the future of the human race and their relationship with drugs, and probably some of the more unique, dumb ideas that I've had over the years. So look forward to that. But first, I guess we're going to talk about what is a drug? And the funny thing is, I was looking for a working definition because you know how people are like, I'd like to start by giving you a dictionary definition of what a drug is. And all right, I'm going to give you a boring-ass dictionary definition of what a drug is because it's an important part of the conversation. It says, any substance which, when absorbed by the body, alters body function. Does that sound a little broad to you?
It sounds quite broad. In that way, I overdosed on drugs earlier today with my delicious Chips Ahoy.
Yeah, it did alter your body. I mean, it sent a surge of sugar in your system, probably forcing your pancreas to excrete insulin, which over time will probably make your body sort of like more resist or less effective at being able to process sugar, thereby giving you, I think, type 2 diabetes. So.
Yeah, that's on its way, I know.
Yeah, we're all hoping for some cures, right, or something?
Later on in life, the Diabetes Express will come for me.
I think it's going to come for most of us, because, I mean, honestly, I don't think I can go a day without having at least 3 pounds of just raw processed sugar in some form or another. That's a lot of pounds.
You're not over-exaggerating a little bit, are you?
3 pounds? Well, no.
Goodness gracious.
I'm trying to figure out how many calories that is and how much that translates into sugar. Okay, it's not 3 pounds, but it's a lot of sugar. Your body is essentially, or at least your brain, is entirely dependent on the energy from sugar. It turns out that it's so damn tasty. We have a problem with it. I know I do. I'm pretty sure that Mr. Cookie Pants over here shares my same kind of like inability to say no to sugar.
Yeah, it's true. Sugar and carbs which break down into sugars. It's all delicious stuff. All the fats, the saturated ones especially, delicious. Our brain loves them.
Actually, that reward mechanism, that's a pretty important thing that we're going to talk about a little bit later, because a significant amount of drugs, they hijack that. So
absolutely.
If you really want to understand, first of all, why you do most of the things that you do in life, understand that most of them have some kind of reward mechanism hidden in there. You ever wonder why it feels good hanging out with friends? Why you enjoy the feeling of love and sex? You think there's something magical about it, or perhaps a release of chemicals to make you addicted to these types of behaviors? I ask you, what is more likely? Okay? I want to take a pragmatic approach to this fucking idea of how human beings behave, right? I don't want to be all romantic about it. I just want to accept the fact that our brains are essentially catering to this type of reward scenario. I think it makes sense, though. I mean, we're extremely complex as a species, so we can't expect, like, say, an ant to rely solely on instinct to guide our fucking behavior. If you only relied on that, well, the society will be a lot more rapier and killier.
Those are good words. I like those words.
But, yeah, I mean, we accept the fact that, sure, I mean, we have our instincts, and they pull us in different directions. But, I mean, to some degree, we recognize the fact that to control behavior, it's, you know, instinct is a kind of very expensive, slow-to-develop type of mechanism. It's a lot easier to just develop a reward mechanism that just taps into the right types of behavior that leads to survival. So you're like, well, okay, we're going to make it pleasurable for you to live in a group rather than pleasurable for you to live alone. And what are the results of that? Well, incredible success in our fucking case, because trust me, if it was really much more rewarding for you to be alone, we'd still be a bunch of naked monkeys trying to survive being hunted by countless predators. You are not a very successful species when it comes to, like, physical attributes. I got bad news for you, man. You're kind of a generalist. You're crappy in terms of strength, pretty crappy in terms of speed, sense of smell. I mean, what do we got going on that's not being beaten by any other specialist in nature, except for a fucking brain? A delicious, gigantic brain. And that brain functions along this sort of reward good behavior, try to punish bad behavior, and memorize traumatic behavior. That last part can be a doozy. I want to get away from just where how the brain works, and I want to talk about just drugs in our society, right? Because, all right, we recognize that the brain, the human brain, is susceptible to anything that might kind of tap into that reward mechanism. But what is it about drugs, specifically the kind of drugs that we enjoy or use recreationally? What is it about them that makes them so pleasurable, right? Like, why don't you like catnip? I don't get off on catnip, but you watch cat on catnip, and it looks pretty orgasmic, I gotta say.
It does. It looks like kitty ecstasy.
Which I'm pretty sure it is. This leads me to a tangent that I want to talk about. I think that every species on this earth has a kind of companion plant that just gets it high as shit. And maybe even nobody else. Maybe you kind of develop a close kinship with a plant. Just for some weird reason, that plant works with your brain chemistry, and bam, you got yourself a weird relationship that you don't quite understand. Cats and catnip, man. What the fuck is that about? Like, what is the advantage? Like, why do cats like catnip? Do they rub themselves in it and then the catnip spreads around? Like, how did that relationship fucking develop? Like, what is the deal?
I just think that, sometimes you fall into these interesting situations where something will just affect you in some interesting way. I mean, animals getting drunk on fermented fruit. It just naturally happens. The world is a wide and varied place, and different things react differently with different kinds of creatures, and it's just wonderful like that. I like your totally hippy-dippy Rastafarian idea that every animal has its stoner device, man. Just gotta go out and find it. Find your drug, man.
Well, I don't mean that as a kind of, there's a magical plant out there for everyone, but I always thought, imagine an alien species lands on Earth, wants to communicate with their fucking leaders, and says, we're going to exchange culture and information. One of the questions that I think they would ask is, what plants or what other organic compounds have a profound influence on you? Because if you think that those things don't matter, then I think you're an idiot. I mean, imagine that we lived in a world in which cats ruled, okay? You don't think that somehow the plant that is catnip would latch itself onto this organism and become, incredibly successful.
Like as if cats ruled the world, then catnip would be the Coca-Cola of the cat master race.
Catnip would be the marijuana. No, catnip would be the marijuana of mankind.
Okay, I could dig that. I'm starting to see like some kind of Fritz the Cat style cartoon where you've got all these cats dealing catnip. I can dig it.
Okay, well, this segues me into a good point about actually how marijuana affects human beings, because catnip to cats is a bit similar to what cannabinoids are to most vertebrate animals. This is the weird thing about cannabis, because if you are a vertebrate animal, odds are you have a nervous system that has what are called cannabinoid receptors. They're located all over your body. There's no specific place where there's where they're located. We have some in our liver, in our lungs, and we also have a shitload of them in our brains. So, turns out that about 5,000 years ago, there's a plant in the area near Kazakhstan that developed that used a specific compound to try to deter other species from eating it. The crazy thing about how cannabinoids worked on at least mammalian brains, because as far as I understand, there's a bit of a ubiquitous sort of effect when it comes to mammals, where your short-term memory is affected, you have a kind of like weird pseudo-psychedelic episode. It's very mild acid, so odds are you're just going to trip fucking balls, and then the plant will survive because you won't eat all of it. You'll eat some of it, and then you're just going to be like, freak out. And this plant turns out to have kind of a very unique influence on us, which is why if you look at any drug classification from any country, right, where they decide what is classified as a drug, and specifically what is classified as an illegal drug, you'll notice that even in places where it's legal, and these are not many places in the world, but cannabinoids are actually a separate group of drugs because of the way that they influence the brain. This is also why people are always, when they're pro-marijuana, they're like, marijuana's never killed anyone and it's not addictive and all these other kinds of things that marijuana activists are always fucking yelling on about. Well, it's because it's true, goddammit. It's so true that it is. It's a class of its own. It's weird because cannabinoids are essentially the perfect drug for humans, with which I mean you're very unlikely to ever overdose off this drug because it doesn't influence the rest of your body like, say, most alkaloids like cocaine, mescaline. Does heroin? No, heroin's not an alkaloid. But anyways, most substances that are hallucinogenic or, you know, extremely powerful and have an influence on your system, they, you know, the, like, whatever system they tap into, how they're absorbed into the body is very different from the way that marijuana is absorbed into the body. And that has a profound influence on, say, the how much you can take of a drug before your body just essentially kind of kaputs, right? So, and I think to some degree we all know that there are some drugs that are much more dangerous than others, right? Like what if I were to ask you what are the three most dangerous drugs off the top of your head, what would they be?
Heroin, crack, and let's see, what's a good third one? I'm drawing a blank on the third. Sorry, I got two good ones.
Okay, well, here are my three basically worst drugs. There's heroin, there's crack and cocaine, which is essentially the same thing, and then there's crystal meth. These three ones I would classify as probably being the scariest of the drug, particularly cocaine that's in the crack form, like crack cocaine, for the reason that it basically only gets you high for 30 minutes, and then after that, you just... You never get high the same way, but you just need it to function. That's a pretty shitty drug, if you ask me. In terms of payoff, right? Crack is bad. And meth puts pinholes in your brain.
Oh, but meth is the one that put... I thought ketamine was the one that put pinholes in your brain. I'm sure there's a bunch of different ones that, you know, based on the added ingredients that you might not want in there, because God knows how these things are being cooked. You're getting all sorts of fun things in there that are doing all sorts of interesting things to your brain as well. Yay! Impurities.
Well, here's a question. I mean, you were doing a little bit of research on the history of drugs and religion, and it goes back, I mean, probably as far as we can go. Like, we do know that most forms of religion have at least some drug incorporated into them, at least at some point. I mean, you look at the ancient Greek mystery religions, and they're fucking on peyote and shit.
Yep, the oracles of Delphi, probably getting high off fumes coming out of a spring. There's all sorts of examples where holy places that they went to later on were just basically gigantic ganja farms or...
Native Americans fucking crazy, trippy ceremonies, like, this is a vision quest. And you'll notice that a lot of substances which have hallucinogenic properties, at the very least, they tend to be incorporated in religious ritual, specifically. And I think it's just because there is something that is, you know, like, drugs are interesting because they really do influence the way that our brain chemistry works. And when you influence the way that the brain chemistry works, sometimes some really fucking crazy shit happens. Now... I want to talk about my drug story for just 5 seconds, because I think it's important to recognize the fact that anybody who would have known me as a young man, probably my early 20s, would have said that I would have been the last spokesperson for anti-prohibitionism. Right? I didn't drink until I was like 21. Never, you know, I didn't smoke marijuana until I was like 28. I was really very anti-drug. Until I actually... I'm trying to remember what year this was. I think this was 2006. I read a book about... Well, I read two books. One was about prohibitionism in the United States during the 1920s to about 1933. And the second book that I read was called The Great Drug War, which really basically talked about the way that the war on drugs is actually handled. Because if you ask most people, you know... What is the war on drugs all about? People will tell you, well, you know, it's arresting folks and breaking down, like, pot farms and crack dens and what have you. But you're not really aware of the way that the war on drugs actually waged outside of your shores, which is where a majority of the funding actually goes to, and how that influences the rest of the world. How the things that you do recreationally or how other human beings behave has a vast influence, especially when it comes to drugs in particular. Because we have a very schizophrenic relationship with drugs is the best way that I can put it. We recognize the fact that we, you know, drugs are a part of everyday life. I think it's something like a third of all Americans have tried marijuana at some point in their lives, okay? That means that a third of the population of the United States could have at least at one point been arrested, charged with a crime, and imprisoned. And that, right away, should kind of tell you that we have a bit of a, you know, like, this is a bit of a weird relationship here. Why would, imagine any other state in which something that a third of your population did that made them eligible to be a criminal and prosecuted and jailed. Doesn't that seem kind of strange to you?
They're called scoff laws, and there's unfortunately a whole bunch of them. The sad reality nowadays is that there's so many things that we do on a day-to-day basis that put us on the wrong side of the law. Download that TV show, watch that movie illegally, checking out sports on a stream or something like that. So many things that we do, and of course there's all sorts of stuff related to drugs or just what you're putting in your own body that technically might not be legal, but...
It's funny that you mentioned scoff laws, because I find that, you know, any country that creates laws that its own citizens don't either respect or, you know, or even know about, what you're creating is a very dangerous situation where a significant portion of your population becomes de facto scoff laws, right? Do you not think that in those situations people will have less of, you know, less respect for the law? I always found it's kind of weird that we try to legislate private morality, and then we're surprised when not only people are not obeying these laws, but then we're just sort of complaining about the fact that everyone's a scofflaw. You created laws that were not realistic, that had nothing to do with the way that people behaved and everything to do with a kind of morality about people's actions. And I think that if you go back and you look at the history of prohibitionism, like serious attempts to make drugs illegal and controlled by organizations, you know, particularly governments, you'll notice that the trend here is essentially that it's twofold. The first part of it is that what you'll notice is that during the Industrial Revolution, there's an increase in industrial populations. And that also means an increase in poverty, and as a consequence, an increase in drug use. In the United States, in the late 1800s, everybody found that the one drug that everybody was abusing was alcohol, mostly because of its availability. And what you get is essentially a very conservative religious uprising called the Second Great Awakening in the United States, which saw as part of its mandate to get rid of alcohol problems for both legitimate and illegitimate reasons. I mean, I'll give you an example. Essentially, this is my history of the 18th Amendment. If you're not familiar with that, with the 18th Amendment, it's basically what made alcohol illegal in the United States for over a decade. Okay, this is when the great experiment on trying to control a substance that is highly popular was run. And I think it's important to understand the history of it, because I think that we can see the same phenomenons happening in today's quote-unquote war on drugs. So let's go back. I want to go back to 1874, okay? I think this is roughly about 40 years after the Second Great Awakening, so America's a fucking ablaze with new faith, religion, plenty, and that kind of stuff. And they need it because... After the Civil War and all the fucking destruction and mayhem that that brought, and the increased poverty and the, you know, the urbanization of the population, what we notice is that a lot of poor, uneducated men are drinking and abusing their wives as a consequence. So in 1874, there's an organization called the Women's Christian Temperance Union that it becomes established. And they believe, and it's not necessarily 100% wrong, that alcohol is part of the reason why women are being beaten. So they decide that they're going to go around and they're going to encourage people to lower their use of alcohol. They're like, well, this is a problem, and clearly we need to deal with it. Now, here's the thing. They're partially right. It was a problem. I think like any other solutions that we see, when we notice, okay, there's an increase in drug use, in areas in which there's poverty. So rather than try to understand, well, why do people who are poor want to use more drugs, they decide we should get rid of drugs. That's not a solution. That's actually adding to the problem. So, but again, I think at this point, I mean, back in the 1800s, we're still dealing with temperance. Okay, I want to make sure that everybody understands when we say temperance and prohibitionism, they're related, but they're not the same. Temperance is is mostly like stop doing what you're doing so much. Prohibition is that's now illegal. So shortly after the Women's Christian Temperance Union gets established, they go around and they go to saloons. Okay, you can see propaganda. Well, not propaganda posters, but like comics of this old time, because they didn't have, you know, really good pictures back then. But you'll see drawings of women on their knees singing in front of saloons, because their whole thing was that we want to shame men that had come to these establishments not drinking anymore. And that was essentially their first strategy. Their second strategy was they started publishing books teaching kids about the dangers of alcohol according to their fundamentalist religious beliefs. And they made a fucking fortune doing it. Okay? The woman that wrote the book, her name was Mary Hunt. She was probably the most powerful woman in America at that time. And she amassed a fortune publishing these textbooks that were basically being sold to schools. And when she died, nobody could agree on what to do with her money. And I'm pretty sure by that time, women didn't have that many rights anyways. So all the money was taken and an establishment, like an organization was created called the Scientific Temperance Federation. And this was an organization whose aim it was to prove scientifically whatever religious dogma they wanted to prove in relationship to drinking.
Sounds like the right way to do science.
I just love how you can just throw it in the name of your foundation and feel, you know, you're like, we're doing science. We got it in our name, man. I mean, I bet you most people who are Scientologists feels like there's science involved because the word science is in it. It's like Scientology. That's about science, right? No. It's exactly the opposite of science.
And I never understood that Christian Science Monitor, that magazine or newspaper or website or whatever the heck it's all about.
Well, Christian Science is basically a cult that says that if your child gets sick, then you have to pray. That's Christian Science. I don't know what the Christian Science Monitor is. Maybe they monitor people who are crazy. I don't give a shit.
And my understanding is always that it's a lot less Christian than the name implies, and that are actually kind of even-keeled, but don't quote me on that or put that in your information banks to pull out at a party. It might be completely wrong.
Now this is, we mentioned the Scientific Temperance Foundation, which is a kind of grassroots political movement associated with a prohibition-like party. You know, a kind of, like today's pot party. Like, they don't have any candidates, but they go around trying to force people to do whatever the hell they want. Like most impotent political organizations. Okay, so this is the Scientific Temperance Foundation, but the whole movement gets like a new revival when a guy by the name of Howard H. Russell, who's like a former lawyer who suddenly has like a fucking conversion, you know, is born again, decides to become a minister, and he creates something called the Anti-Saloon League. And the thing about the league is they're founded like a business rather than a church. So they groom leaders. They try to structure themselves like, you know, any other non-wishy-washy organization. So he brings business acumen to the scene, and he has some success. But then he steps down, and a guy by the name of Wayne Wheeler takes over. Now, this guy is probably one of the most significant individuals to have ever lived in the earliest parts of the 20th century. I shit you not. Okay? This man invented pressure politics. You know, when you're using sort of like the political action of mass media and mass communication to make politicians do what you want? This guy invented this. And his Anti-Saloon League basically felt that rather than doing the whole temperance thing, which they felt was not doing anything, they wanted to go for full-out prohibitionism, which means making alcohol illegal, or making any drug illegal, but in this case, their focus was really on alcohol. If you look at the term Wheelerism, that's a term referring to pressure politics, by the way. So this is how significant this guy is. He had two presidents under his fucking, you know, iron boot, countless congressmen, whatever. I mean, when in 1919, when they passed the Volstead Act, which essentially was paved the way for the 18th Amendment, which made alcohol illegal, the very name of Andrew Volstead, who was part of the Volstead Act, he was just a puppet, Wayne Wheeler, who drafted the bill himself. Just to give you an idea of the power of this man.
Yeah, it's always creepy when you look at certain bits of legislation that ended up being drafted by the very people that they're supposed to regulate and so forth. It's one of those joys of democracy that you look at, and it kind of gets you a little bit angry.
Yeah, just a little bit. And the funny thing about the Anti-Saloon League is what differentiated them from past, you know, sort of, you know, the temperance movement is that they did not care whether or not the candidates that they chose drank or not. They weren't really committed to an ideological idea. They were mainly interested in changing the legislature. Okay, their plan was like, fuck trying to just convince people we will use government. We will amend the Constitution, which is what they did. In January 16th, 1919, they amended the U.S. Constitution to make it a crime to drink alcohol. Now, the Volstead Act covered a couple parts. Number one, it made alcohol illegal for consumption, and it also sort of regulated non-recreational alcohol manufacturing, like, you know, rubbing alcohol and so on and so forth, because you just, it doesn't matter if alcohol is illegal, you're still going to have to make it, because it's in stuff, like thermometers and whatever. It's insanely useful fucking fluid.
It's part of the manufacturing process.
It is. And the third thing they wanted to do was they wanted to make sure that there was plenty of alcohol available specifically for religious ceremonies. So they were making very special provisions. It would be like, well, if the priests want to get drunk, they still can.
Well, even though the wine, I know some people are okay with switching it to grape juice, but as far as I'm concerned, if Jesus was like wine, blood, I'm like, the wine is blood. This whole grape juice thing, I always thought that's pretty bullshit. If you're going to be drinking blood,
it's weak, sir.
Transmogrified blood. It better be from the original to the other one. I don't know whether or not grape juice passes.
It's transubstantiated.
Sorry.
God, you're so ignorant. How can you criticize religion when you don't even know that? Jeez.
Pretty sure my word still works, sort of.
It does. That's the funny thing. It's still a good word. It's just not their word that they use.
Gotcha.
Now, here's the thing that happened. Okay, so the 18th Amendment gets passed, but the funny thing that happens right after is that no one really had any foresight about what was going to happen. I mean, it was pretty bad. Like, basically, these companies, like, say, most alcohol companies, like liquor companies that exist in the United States that are told you're no longer in business anymore. Well, it's not as though if you tomorrow, if any drug was to become illegal that was already legal, it's not as though you have a huge-ass supply of the stuff lying around. Typically, when you manufacture stuff, you're not selling it the next day, okay? So that was the first problem. They had a huge store of alcohol, and they had these weird rules about how people could be qualified. Now, there are a few very famous people that managed to exploit that. I'm trying to remember the name of one guy who was even bigger than Al Capone, and he wasn't even a criminal. He was just a business guy who decided, hey, I can convince government organization to give me license to essentially distribute and distill or take the alcohol storage for myself, and then I'll just sell it illegally. And made so much money. And that's the funny thing about the process is everybody, even Wayne Wheeler, who's, I will not take anything away from Wayne Wheeler. The man is brilliant, but he didn't think about what would happen fucking day zero when alcohol is illegal. In fact, they didn't even realize that rather than discourage people from drinking, it actually made drinking more popular. Like, everyone who wanted to have some fun would go to, like, these speakeasies, like these places where, You could drink all night. You didn't have to show ID. You could just drink till your heart's content, fucking, and stuff that would make people blind. Like, the least safe drug out there is the one that's not being regulated, especially the one that's illegal. They tend to actually be more dangerous when they're illegal. Funny thing about it.
Absolutely. I mean, the interesting parallels here is obviously to pot and what's going on in Mexico with, you know, the gangs cutting hundreds of people's heads off and being at war with the police and basically killing everybody.
Well, look at Prohibition in America, where regular citizens were being murdered because they were trying to, you know, snitches were getting killed left and right and probably being killed by their fucking fellows, you know, not by criminals, but by people who just didn't want to go to jail because they thought that alcohol was fun. And that's a really fucked up thing. Like, I want to run through just right now, because we'll talk about how the 18th Amendment was essentially repealed. But first, what I wanted to talk about was just kind of the prohibition that exists today in America, that's probably the most significant, which is prohibition against marijuana, right? Compared to most other drugs, I would say that since marijuana in the United States is the number one cash crop, okay, put that in perspective, marijuana makes more money than corn, which is subsidized, okay? Marijuana makes more money than any other crop in America. It is smoked by a third of its citizens. Every year, 800,000 people are incarcerated in the U.S. on drug charges. The vast majority, about 89% of these, are for marijuana possession. When you think about the real effects of that, where you're saying, okay, well, not only are 800,000 people arrested, but incarcerated, but nearly 2 million people are actually arrested. And if you know how it is to go through the system, okay, to be a victim of that fucking shit, you know it's awful. And marijuana arrests have been going up in recent years, not been going down, despite the fact that the population of America feels that marijuana laws are bad. And yet, arrests have increased.
And the violence of the arrests, too. Like, if you read, there's a blog that I read on and off because, honestly, it gets a little bit depressing. It's called theagitator.com, and the guy is a libertarian that covers basically what the cops are up to and the increased police state that we live in. And he talks all the time about all these situations where SWAT teams will go in with their armored trucks and their crazy assault weapons, and they'll bust through people's doors, and they'll just raid the house. And half the time, the people in the house have no idea what's going on. They'll pull out a gun because they think that they're being home invaded, and they'll end up shooting a cop. And they'll go to jail for a really long time, or they'll just get shot up too. There's a number of cases, and a lot of the times that this happens, a lot of the times where things go wrong, the police have the wrong house, or the police got the information from a snitch who was lying, who was implicating somebody who had nothing to hide or had done nothing. The number of times these cops have come in and just killed innocent people, it's staggering. And of course, as soon as you go in, any dogs that live in that house, they're going to get shot too. It's amazing, the militarization of the police, all in the name of catching these evil drug dealers, these marijuana dealers. It's quite terrifying.
Well, it's every 38 seconds in the U.S., someone is being arrested for smoking marijuana. And the crazy thing about that is, if you were to ask, like, you know, if you were to put it to popular vote, people would legalize the drug for the same reason why they decided that prohibitionism of alcohol was not a good idea. I mean, imagine post, like, prohibitionism, where alcohol had just essentially been regulated and sold by legitimate companies. Now the profit margin of alcohol, selling illegal alcohol, was skyrocketed because the interest in getting drunk never went down. It's not just because the anti-saloon lead decided that everyone else should not drink that people thought, yeah, you know what? Wayne Wheeler and his bunch of religious nut jobs are right. I shouldn't drink and try to escape the misery of my own fucking life, right? I don't have any right to do this. My body is not my own. It apparently belongs to some dead Palestinian carpenter that lived 2,000 fucking years ago and who decides for everybody else what they're going to put in their bodies, regardless of the influence on anyone else. It's like, no, sorry, not your body. It belongs to Jesus and the church.
Even though Jesus was totally down with wine. I mean, think about the fish, the loaves, the wine. I mean, this guy is a dude who knew how to pull a party out of his ass, literally.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you show up at a hill with a whole bunch of fish and wine, that's a party back then. That's a fucking party. I know that there's a lot of people, I'm pretty sure even folks on the site, that have this, that feel that, you know, drug laws are intended to protect people, and, you know, if you made drugs legal, it would just essentially destabilize society, or so on and so forth. And I'm familiar with all the arguments. In fact, I'm going to present them, because I used to believe in those same arguments. Like I said before, I mean, I was, to some degree, a prohibitionism kind of guy. Probably more like a temperance, like because I've always hated laws. But prohibition is where I would have leaned to in the past because of my feeling towards drugs. And I would have said, here are the six arguments that I would have presented maybe 10 years ago as to why some drugs should be illegal. The first one I would say is that people need to be protected from the harmful effects of drugs, which is why we make them illegal. Number two, crime is caused by increased drug use. Number three, making illegal drugs, making drugs illegal makes it harder for kids to use them. Number four, limited information on drugs means people are less likely to experiment with drugs. So if I just don't tell them about it, they won't try it. Number five, drugs are harmful. All drugs are harmful. Number six, attempting to stop the supply of drugs make them less accessible. All right, now I'm going to give you the six reasons why that's not true, why none of those things are true. So number one, if you think that protecting people from drugs means that you're going to make them, like, by, you know, you protect them by making them illegal, I don't think you really realize the cycle of how these things function. So if you make a drug illegal, you're not preventing anyone from actually using it. What you're doing is you're changing the structure about how it's distributed. That's all. So you go from having a legal distribution that's fairly regulated, and you know, in the sense that you make sure that people who are not minors don't have access to this. You sort of establish certain guidelines to relative potency of the drug, the purity, and so on and so forth. That is gone. Instead, what you have now is a system where a black market exists and a tremendous amount of money can be made without, you know, like the market is there. And as we all know, if a market's there, it's going to be exploited. So the problem is that if you think that you're protecting people by making a drug illegal, but in effect, there's so many tertiary ways in which you're actually harming people, not only by making organized crime richer from simply having now a new form of income, but also the drugs that people are consuming being less safe because they're not being manufactured by a fucking body of criminals being like, let's make sure that our drugs are good. No such thing. They don't give a shit. As long as they sell and they make money, they don't care. They don't give a shit. Now, and if you think that crime is lowered or sort of like crime is caused by drugs, you're right in the sense that the ability to make billions of dollars off drug sales definitely do increase very organized and very dangerous crime. Like, you need money to do big crime. And drugs are a good way to do it. The other thing that I think that people say is that, well, if you make a drug illegal, kids are less likely to use them. Well, if that was true, we would see a trend where kids would consume more of the legal drugs versus the illegal drugs, and we don't find much of a difference. In fact, in some instances, we actually find kids using more illegal drugs because guess what? Drug dealers don't ask kids for ID, do they?
Yeah, it seems like it's always hard for kids to be able to get their hands on beer, but marijuana, not so much.
Not so much, yeah. You'll often find kids being like, hey, can you get me some alcohol, please, Mr. Adult? I can get anything else, but there's no profit in selling illegal alcohol. There's just none. And that's the really weird and fucked up thing that nobody wants to admit to. That if you make something illegal and people still want it, you really do make it attractive for the wrong kinds of individuals, right? Here's another argument, when the limited information about drugs argument. I remember actually there is some legitimacy to that, where people who are less aware of all the different types of drugs and their effects are less likely to try them. But the problem with that is they're also more likely to become addicted to them, right? The ones that do try. So what you're trying to trade off here is saying, well, the people that, you know, if we educate them more, yes, they are more likely to experiment, but they're less likely to become addicted. That's not worth it. Because in fact, we don't want anyone to try them in the first place. This is the idea that we've kind of latched onto. This is what we think is the best strategy. Let's not tell anyone about the influence and effects on drugs, or let's be completely, let's lie to kids and tell them that drugs are only bad. Let's do that. Because when they try it and they find out that the effects are, well, a lot more enjoyable and a lot less dangerous than what they were told, guess what they'll think about everything else you told them? They'll think it's a fucking lie.
Yeah, marijuana and ecstasy is pretty awesome. And as soon as, no matter what you tell a kid, once he does it, he's going to think you're full of shit.
Yeah, and the problem is, I mean, marijuana and ecstasy, if you were to believe the classifications of these drugs, you would assume that they are as dangerous as heroin as cocaine. And anyone who's experimented with any kind of drugs will tell you that no. Everyone knows that there's obviously some difference here, but how are people supposed to trust organizations that give them false information about drugs in an effort to discourage them from using it? It's like the idea of telling a kid, well, if you use marijuana, it's going to be a gateway drug. When there's, not only is there no evidence to suggest that that's true, but there's much more evidence to suggest that cigarettes is the gateway drug. You don't exactly see people lobbying to have cigarette companies brought down because they are the gateway drug of the world. And actually, if they were, I'd probably be on the cigarette company's side, as fucked up as that is.
Yeah, you have to have some strange bedfellows when you're arguing for some of these things.
I think in particular, I mean, this is probably surprising to some, but, you know, like, I think that cigarettes should definitely be legal. I think every drug should be legal. As much as there are certain drugs that I detest, that I fear, that I know are dangerous for people because of the way that they function, I know that creating an environment in which the only way for people to get those is through dangerous and deadly means, it's not a good idea. Like, how am I protecting someone when I ensure that they are doing things in the least safe way possible? Literally. Share your needles, because we don't want to deal with the reality that people do heroin. No. We don't want to deal with that reality. Forget about the dangers of alcohol. That one's legal. Ecstasy and marijuana are much more dangerous. Really, are they? Because anybody who's actually used them will tell you that no, they are not. And any serious scientist will tell you that, you know, all drug policies are not based on science. They're based on this kind of perception of morality when it comes to drugs. And where does that morality really come from? Well, in my opinion, if you look at really the history of most type of, you know, sort of temperance or prohibition movements, you'll see that there is always a very strong religious component to it. Because as far as religions are concerned, your body is not yours, your actions are not yours to decide, and there's the thought police here every fucking day to make sure that you're not messing up and essentially leading to some kind of hellish Satan world that they're afraid of.
Yeah, your only spiritual enlightenment that you're allowed to get is through the church. And if you're getting it yourself through magic mushrooms, acid, LSD, or DMT, or any of those other things, you're doing it wrong. Even though I'd say those are a much cooler way of going about it.
Now, here's the thing I do want to mention about drugs themselves. Now, we did talk about the fact that, you know, we're not having a very adult conversation when we're not honest about, you know, with kids about the effects on drugs. And as a consequence, it erodes their trust in what we have to say. But what we should be telling kids that decide to experiment with drugs is to tell them that drugs are like a relationship. That's the way I characterize my use of either alcohol or marijuana. These are my two drugs, okay? Less alcohol, more marijuana. Just because I feel I cannot stand the hangover of alcohol. But nevertheless, I have a relationship with these drugs, and it's not always a good relationship. Number one, I don't enjoy the cost of either two because they're very expensive. I find that sometimes my dependency on these types of drugs, you know, like in order to feel relaxed or, you know, calm, that kind of stuff, is annoying. I would love to kind of, you know, sometimes reach that homeostasis without the necessity of certain drugs. I have accepted that whenever you try something recreationally, there is the opportunity for you to really develop a bit too strong of a relationship with it. And it can change your, you know, it can structure your life. I mean, if you decide that you do want to smoke pot, you have to accept the possibilities that you can get fucked over. You can be one of those almost 2 million fucking people every year getting arrested, facing, you know, a different life now, different choices, different opportunities, because your government has decided that this particular plant is illegal. And there's not much you can do about it. In fact, anytime any of you guys try to, you know, be reasonable about it, say, hey, we could certainly use the billions of dollars of money we would make from taxing the stuff and not have to spend $41 billion in trying to fight something that everyone's just doing.
And plus, like many relationships, if you end up spending too much time with this particular girlfriend, you might just cut everything else out of your life. You know those people that get into those relationships and they disappear from your social group? Trust me, there are many people that this happens to with marijuana. They just sit around all the time smoking weed and not doing very much. And it can cause changes in personality and just changes of general level outgoingness and sociability and so forth. It changes the way that you are, the way that you act, and the way that your brain works. These are important things that people have to remember as far as marijuana.
I just wish we could have that adult conversation with people, right? Where it really was their option. Who feels that it's fair to make the decision for someone else regarding something like that, right? Because as I mentioned before, I mean, this is a private morality here. How a person feels about what they put into their body is not really the concern of anyone else. I really don't even care what those substances are. In a sense, they are merely controlling the chemistry of their own body in the way that they choose fit. Whether or not that's a good idea is not for me to decide.
Yeah, but this is where you've got the state stepping in and basically saying this goes against the interest of the state, aka to have industrious, sober individuals who are able to participate in today's commerce society.
But that's bullshit anyways. Do you know how many functional drug addicts there are in this world?
Most of us.
Most of us are functional drug addicts to some degree. I mean, your drug could be pot, fucking cigarettes, alcohol, food, anything that you're using to essentially alter the chemistry of your body to make you feel like the weight of the world is not crushing your soul.
Yeah, one of the funny things is coffee used to be a hot-button subject in England.
Oh man, remember coffee house? And they're like, this is where people go to talk about revolution and their upheaving society.
Yep, the women were just as against us as they were saloons, because basically guys would get all jazzed up from fucking coffee and they'd come home and they'd beat their wives, and it got to the point where they were talking about how it fomented communism and other ideas. People would just get together, drink tons of coffee, and just talk mad shit to each other for like days on end.
Manic shit. This kind of stuff that you expect when you're high on fucking caffeine.
Absolutely. It would have been very interesting to see to experience this, hanging out with these people, throwing down cups of coffee like they are like a mug of beer, and seeing how that plays out. Because I recently never realized the enjoyment of going out for friends with coffee and sitting down with them and drinking like two cups and realizing that it does change the dynamic of the conversation. You are high after you've consumed those two cups, and it affects the way that you behave and it affects the way that you react. Things are more funny. You're more sociable. It's just like any other drug. It's just got a bit of a different... It's like the difference between how you are when you're drunk off wine, off beer. I mean, energy drinks to coffee, they're different highs, but they are highs nonetheless.
Maybe this can bring us back to the general discussion about what do we classify as a drug? I mean, the problem is, I mean, it's broad because most independent governments want to decide for themselves what drugs they make legal and what drugs they make illegal. and what they're going to control. And as soon as that's true, I've always felt that there's something kind of suspicious about the whole thing. Like, why are people so intent on gaining control over this? And while it's true that a part of it could be money, the honest truth is that our reaction to drugs in Western society has been to moralize it rather than have a kind of pragmatic approach to it. And the result has been disastrous. I mean, think about this. Everybody always jokes being like, oh, you know, drugs lead to terrorism. 90% of all the heroin on Earth is produced in Afghanistan. Okay? Where do you think the money is going?
Terrorism.
Yeah. I mean, I hate to say it, but that's where it is. It's going. And I would love to go over and try to grab every heroin addict and saying, hey, when you shoot up, you're shooting with Bin Laden. Well, he's dead, but whatever. But that itself is kind of like a big... Why do I want to blame the fucking victim? As far as I'm concerned, the people that are hooked on fucking heroin are victims, all right? It is an extremely difficult drug for people to get off of. You know, some human beings are vulnerable at some point in their life. Maybe they were given some really fucking bad advice. Now they're hooked on drugs. So what should I do? Throw them in jail? I don't think so, okay? But we feel in our society like the best way to deal with drug addicts is to make sure that we punish them for having made, say, wrong choices about the kinds of relationship they have. Or not even that, of just having made decisions about the things that we're going to put into their own fucking bodies. And that is really messed up. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, legislating drug use is as reasonable as trying to make masturbation illegal. They're entirely unrealistic. And worst of all, in the case of drugs, it actually creates a black market, the size of which is probably beyond our comprehension. I mean, last figures that I read is that there was over every year $1 trillion worth of illicit drug trade worldwide. The only thing that makes more money in this world is agriculture, because people need to eat. But guess what they do next? They get high. And I just feel like we live in a society that wants to not only deny the fact that human beings want to do this, but partially denies the reason why even some of them it's necessary. You know? Oh, well, you shouldn't do drugs. This fucking person's life is miserable. Maybe for them, getting drunk is the only way to not remember the fact that they were raped their entire childhood. I don't know. Life isn't as simple as us to say, just get over it. Don't worry about it. Stop doing these drugs. You're doing something wrong. Fuck off.
And plus, it's kind of narrow-minded to think that people can't use drugs responsibly. I mean, there's a lot of drugs that are positive. As much as I was talking shit about weed before, it's like I had a weed honeymoon, and it made me realize a lot of things about myself, and it made me a better person. And there's a lot of drugs that do that. They're experimenting with soldiers and post-traumatic stress disorder. They're using ecstasy to help them. And ecstasy, when it first came around, was being used all the time by psychologists to help people through marriage problems, etc. And of course,
it's the empathy drug. Of course you would fucking give it to people who have been shooting other human beings for a little while.
Yep, it goes across the gamut. I don't think that there's such a thing as a completely evil drug. Obviously, I think crack and meth are probably pretty close up there, but I think that there's a lot of demonization going on that's kind of unnecessary, and it actually kind of makes everything it makes everything more difficult because you're blurring the lines and you're spreading around a lot of disinformation, and it just causes more problems.
Well, look at this. June 2011, this is very recently, the United Nations Global Commission on Drug Policy released a report saying basically the war on drugs is a failure and has had devastating consequences. Not just it's a failure, this has been a disaster, saying that rather than having these types of, you know, rather than taking this attitude that we need to do war on it and spend money trying to destroy crops and prevent the stuff from coming in, which hilariously enough, according to these same people, actually makes drugs more easy to distribute because the profitability goes higher. We know. I mean, we live in a world in which we recognize that the attempts to do war with drugs has failed. And yet we have changed nothing about our policies. In fact, it's been the complete opposite. And if you've ever wondered, why is it that sort of like, you know, police officers and things like that, why would marijuana arrests and things like that, why would they be on the increase? Well, you see, most organizations, you know, that are funded by the government are always afraid of losing funding. And what's a really good way to sort of like get funding? Well, part of it is if I arrest someone for marijuana possession in a number of states in the U.S., I can seize their assets and sell them. In essence, I can use the profits that I have from these drug possessions to pay for more police officers and more equipment and more ability to police and imprison other people. Do you see the kind of strange and scary trend here?
Yeah, it's a little bit scary how all of that works.
It doesn't exactly make you think that people are trying to work for the good of others. They're just functioning for the good of specific policies that have been disastrous. And I really don't care if you personally feel that you don't want to do drugs, and you know what, truth be told, that's fucking impossible. Aspirin is a drug, okay? But if you really think that you're just this Puritan who doesn't require it at all, and you feel like moralizing your fellow human being, I really want you to keep in mind this notion that trying to prevent people from doing it, trying to urge people not to even, often makes the situation worse. It's just, that's the kind of weird thing about drug use, is that you have to let everyone else take a personal decision about it, and that's it. You're like, you just trust that human beings will tend to try to make the right decisions, and step out of the process, because you make it worse. You make our lives worse. The war on drugs unequivocally has made life worse for every person on this planet in one way or another. I guarantee it.
Yeah, the worst thing that can happen to you when smoking weed is that the government can find out about it, because they can get you fired, arrest you, you could go to jail.
You're forced, you can never leave the country again.
It affects your ability to get a job. You probably, there's always a chance that you can have your kids taken away. Don't forget that one.
Nope, don't forget that one either. So, but you know, I think too, the one thing that I would, you know, if there are people that are listening to this show that, you know, themselves were thinking about experimenting, because I remember when I was in that phase, I had finished reading a book about drug use, and I decided that I was going to change my attitude about it. I wasn't just going to buy into what I had been told. You know, you know that if you believe in anything because it was just essentially drilled in your head by someone else, I think you should be suspicious about it. Okay? You should come to every decision in your life based on, you know, you having educated yourself on it, you having taken careful consideration and seen both sides. And I didn't do that when I was, you know, in my original relationship with drugs. I towed the line, you know, like, this is your brain on drugs, the frying pan with Rachel Lee Cook. Remember that one?
Yep. I remember many of those.
It's not an explanation, right? That's not a fair fucking explanation of what happens on drugs. I'm like, is that what happens when I take Tylenol? Rachel, like, what do you call a drug? Is that what happens when I take antidepressants, OxyContin, or I take a painkiller, steroids? These are drugs. It's like, no. Instead, we're going to have platitudes. And the one thing that it did in my relationship with my mom, because my mom, you know, when I was younger, she smoked pot, and I always made her feel really awful about it. And I think that that's where kind of my own rebellion against her rebellion came from, right? It's weird. Kids always do the opposite of their parents. So it took me a while to get out of this really, I want to say, indoctrinated position that I had on drugs. And it wasn't until I started realizing the real influence that our behavior or our ideas about drugs, how they influence the rest of the world. Like, you are not living in a bubble. The decisions that you make affect everybody else. And we've made always the wrong decisions when it comes to drugs in the past 120 years, like, no doubt. all the wrong fucking decisions. We try to make them illegal. We try to control them. And along the way, all we've done is we've made organized crime stronger. We've made the world less safe. And we've even funded terrorism. So congratulations, everybody. We've made the right choices.
We're doing it right. We're winning.
We're doing it fucking all right. We're winning the war on, the war on intelligence is what we're winning. Anyways, you know what? I think that we're going to cut it short for the show. I think that's a good enough discussion on drugs. You agree?
Yeah, I'm feeling it's pretty good. We got about an hour in there. That I feel is worthy.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, a couple of cool things coming up. Number one is we just received another donation from someone who's been offering a free membership. We're going to try to figure out what's the best strategy to do that. So, and remember how I mentioned that we were going to do surveys and we were going to give out two memberships for the surveys? Remember that?
Yep.
Okay. Well, we're going to do the survey this week. We're going to put that out to, so there's going to be a couple of people that are going to be, free new members. Yay. Of course they can't hear the podcast right now because they aren't members.
They don't know it's coming, but it's coming.
It's coming. I mean, you guys know, right? You're in the know. You paid people. You can be part of the excitement saying, well, we're trying to actually get everybody to get back on the bandwagon, which reminds me, I've been sending an email out to lots of people. If you're a hardcore member and you have been a hardcore member for more than 6 months, you have to send me your information, your address information. In a couple of days, we're going to be unveiling a new shirt design, and part of that shirt design will be the shirts that we ship out to you guys, because I know that people were like, I wanted a shirt, but I don't want the Jesus Saves. Fair enough. I'm not going to force a fucking design you didn't want to buy on you. So if you don't want it, just tell me. But also, I need to know your address, the size that you want to wear. I got to start collecting information. So you want your swag, you got to let me know what the fuck your information is, okay? I don't want to have to remind you too often. Come on, folks. Get organized. Send me your info. It's jake@thegoodatheist.net. And check your emails, because odds are most of you have gotten a reminder saying, like, I need your info, bitch.
Very nice.
Okay, well, you will catch everybody on Tuesday for the next show. I want to remind people that are bonus members that the next bonus show is going to be an Ask God. So you guys have a little bit of extra time to think about what your questions are going to be, all right? But that's the next bonus show. And we'll catch everybody on Tuesday for the free show. With that, my name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Ryan Harkness.
Have a good Atheist Day, everybody.